deflationism and truth. This chap here, Paul Horwich, will figure fairly large in our discussions. He remains, I think, the foremost defender of the style of account of truth that we're going to be ultimately talking about. But I'm going to creep up on deflationism fairly slowly by thinking more generally about what one might want or hope for from a theory of truth. So I'm going to start by talking about pinkness rather than truth, as I've done before. So look at these claims making use of the predication of pinkness or the property of pinkness. So you've got David is pink, Boris is pink, my bedroom walls are pink, my jumper's not pink. Okay, these are kinds of claims one might make. In 1 to 3, various things are said to be pink, and very natural question, right, question that metaphysicians of colour might be concerned to address, be what do all the things said to be pink have in common that differentiates them from the things that aren't pink? Right, what groups all the pink things together and distinguishes them from the non-pink things? And we might attempt to answer that question in something like the following way. We might attempt to fill in the blanks in what we can think of as the P schema, P for pink. Something is pink if and only if, and then we specify some condition. Something has if and only if it's pink. So that'd be a general project that someone might have. They might have a concern to understand pinkness, and one way of addressing that, typically philosophical way of addressing that, would be to attempt to fill in this blank. You might think of similar cases. Someone knows such and such just in case, blah, we provide some failing analysis of knowledge. So there are now various ways to pursue that general project. Okay, so one thing we might reasonably do is to provide kind of list of distinct accounts, perhaps each specific to particular fillings of the left-hand side blank. So we might not aim for one global account of pinkness. We might aim for an account of, you know, wall pinkness, film pinkness, window pinkness, and so forth. So you might have account that says, well, David is pink if and only if, and then we say what it is for David to be pink. Perhaps it's for his skin to have a certain tone. Boris is pink if and only if you say something else. My bedroom walls are pink if and only if, and so forth. So we give a bunch of distinct kinds of accounts for different kinds of subject matters. So notice that we want the right-hand side to get the value true in the first three cases, since the targets are all pink, and we want the right-hand side of 4 to get the value false, since the target there isn't pink. So David's pink, we want that to come out true, so whatever we say over here has to have the same value, so it has to be true. So we want this to be a condition that's met with respect to David. Similarly for Boris. Similarly, let's suppose my bedroom walls, but my shirt isn't pink, so we want, since this side is false, we want this side to specify some condition that's false. Okay, if you gave a, you know, chemical composition that my shirt in fact has, this side would come out true, that side would come out false, so we'd get the wrong result. So on the blanks in the first three to be conditions that are met, on both sides, get the value true on both sides of the biconditional, and the blank in the fourth not to be met, so that both sides get the value false. So that's one thing we might try and do. We might try and give this kind of list form account, right? It might not be quite as crude and crass as distinguishing individual items that bear this property. We might nonetheless want to give different accounts for different kinds of bearer of the property. So, right, you might think that want to tell a different story about what it is for some light to be pink than you want to tell about what it is for a surface to be pink, for example. Nothing a priori precludes that being the best way of going about providing an account of pinkness. Alternatively, instead of providing different accounts for each different thing or each different kind of thing, we might think that there is surely something genuinely in common amongst all of the pink things. Hence, we might attempt to fill out a more general target, such as this kind of pink generalisation. For all items X, X is pink if and only if, and we spell out some condition that everything that's pink has to meet and nothing non-pink meets, I suppose. Perhaps it's some kind of spectral reflectance property or something. Some property of electronic profiles of materials or something like that. So we might, for example, fill out the right-hand side by appeal to something about the way that objects reflect or distort light. And so we might hope to provide a kind of explanatory substantive account of what it is for anything to be pink. Right? General account of what it is for things to be pink. We might think if we could do that, having that kind of account would be better than having the kind of list form account that we started off looking at. So those are two kinds of options you might want to consider with respect to giving such an account of pinkness. As well as asking whether we want our account to be kind of list of specific claims or based around some more general claim, we might also ask what kind of strength we want our account to have. So here are some options. We might simply want our account to be materially correct. Right, for both sides of the biconditionals, or biconditional, to take the same value. Right? We might just want it to be, as a matter of fact, something is pink if and only if it meets this condition. Right? So suppose the all and only the pink things in the world were chairs, then we might be able to meet that condition just by specifying that something's pink just in case it's a chair. So I think that will turn out to be materially correct. So we might think that's all we really want out of an account of pinkness or anything else. Alternatively, and this is the kind of thing that philosophers tend to want more than a materially adequate account, we might want our account to issue in necessarily true biconditionals. Okay? So that it's impossible for something to meet the condition on the right-hand side without being pink and vice versa. Right? So you don't just want to say what all the pink things in fact have in common. You want to say what any possible pink thing will have in common with other possible pink things. So you'll know that if something meets the relevant condition under any other circumstances, that guarantees for you that it's going to be pink. We might want something even more demanding. We might want some kind of a definition of X is pink, an account of what someone knows who understands the expression X is pink, or what someone has in mind when they have the concept of pinkness. Right, so we might want something even more demanding. So you might say, look, meeting the second condition with respect, I don't know how to do this for pinkness, but we might think it's plausible that one can provide such a necessarily true biconditional for things being water by appeal to there being H2O. Okay, it's going to be necessarily true that if you've got some H2O, you've got some water, and if you've got some water, you've got some H2O. No possible circumstances where you have one without having the other, let's suppose. But we might think that wouldn't provide kind of definition of what it is to be water if the aim of providing such a definition was to capture what someone has in mind just by virtue of being able to think about water. Because you might think plenty of folks can think about water without having any kind of specialist chemical knowledge. As you might think, there's a further test involved in this kind of definitional case. You might think that if you get a definition, then your definitional account will be such that it will support the necessary biconditionals. Right? If you've defined what knowledge is or what pinkness is, then you're going to have something that will sustain modally necessary biconditionals, lithically necessary biconditionals. But you might think the converse doesn't hold. You could have the necessary truths without having something that really captured how we think about this stuff. So these are the kinds of options, and you see that some or all of these options are adopted by different approaches, not to pinkness, but to truth. So just as we started with a list of various things being pink, turn to consider, as we've done before, various things being said to be true or not true. So what David said is true. The proposition that Jeremy should resign is true. It's true that David is Prime Minister. The sentence quotes David is Prime Minister is true. And the claim that Jeremy is pink is not true. Right? These are all claims one might make involving the notion of truth. And now, as with our questions about pink, we can ask the following about truth. So one thing we can ask is, what, if anything, do all the truths have in common? Right? What pulls all the truths together and distinguishes them from the untruths, the falsehoods? Second question is, should we give a list account of individual truths? Should we give an account of what each of these individual claims requires separately from all the other cases? Or should we rather attempt to provide an absolutely general account of what it is for anything to be true? And a third kind of question is, well, what sort of strength of account should we go for? Do we want an account that merely provides materially adequate conditions for truth, material conditions for something's being true? Or do we want something that gives you a necessary biconditional with respect to truths? Or do we want some kind of analysis or definition of truth, some account of what someone understands when they're able to think about things excuse me, as true or false? Now, one way of approaching an attempt to provide an account of truth, one way that people have found useful to approach truth, is by appeal to various kinds of platitudes about truth. And some of these are quite specific. So one kind of platitude with respect to one of our cases is that the proposition that Jeremy should resign is true, just in case Jeremy should resign. Right? It's supposed to be obvious that that's correct. Okay? It's a platitude, something that only a philosopher would deny. Second one is similarly obvious, it's supposed. It's true that David is Prime Minister, just in case David is Prime Minister. The sentence quotes David isn't Prime Minister is true, if and only if David is Prime Minister, we might think is obvious. The claim that Jeremy is pink is not true, if and only if Jeremy is not pink. Okay, you might think that's obviously correct. Now, one way of thinking about these platitudes and thinking about why we might be inclined to agree that they are platitudes is by thinking about how you might find out that the proposition that David is pink is true, whether the proposition that David's pink is true or not true. What would you do to find out whether that proposition is true or not true? And it's natural to think that one's procedure would go via attempting to find out whether or not David is pink. Right? You want to know whether the proposition that David is pink is true. Well, see whether David's pink. Okay? If he is pink, then it's true. If he's not pink, then it's not true. And that's supposed to be a platitude. So questions about, on this kind of view, questions about the truth or falsity of propositions are closely connected with more simple facts about the properties of individual items. Right? So whether the proposition that David's pink is true, right, whether that proposition has the property of truth, turns on whether David has the property of being pink or not. Okay? Check one to determine the other. I mean, there are two suggestions here. One is that determining these things runs in step. So similarly, just as to find out whether the proposition's true, find out whether David's pink, we might have gone in the other direction, found out whether David's pink by finding out whether the proposition's true. The natural suggestion, natural way of thinking about the platitude is that that's not how we ordinarily proceed. We first find out whether David's pink, and we use that to parlay up into a judgment about whether the proposition that David's pink is true or not. Okay, so obviously enough, these platitudes themselves seem to have some kind of commonalities. Seem to have something in common, at least the ones about propositions, and they're going to be our main focus. We might try to capture that by a kind of generalisation. So we generalise over all those individual claims about propositional truth and try to say something like this. For all propositions, the proposition that P is true if and only if P. Okay, and then the idea is that we slot in sentences for P and we always get true outputs. So proposition that David's pink is true if and only if David is pink. Proposition that Jeremy should resign is true if and only if Jeremy should resign. Proposition, the philosopher's favourite proposition, the proposition that snow is white is true if and only if snow is white, and so forth. Right? Get this kind of generalisation. It's the idea. I'm going to come back and talk at some point about worry about that mode of generalisation, because ordinarily, at least with respect to the simple kinds of logics we ordinarily exploit, first order logics, this kind of universal generalisation would be generalisation over individual objects. That's how we ordinarily think about universal generalisations. So everything that meets some condition meets some other condition. For example, we talk about things. In that case, replacements for the variable would be something like names for individual items that we were generalising over. In this case, however, the position we're quantifying over is a position occupied by sentences rather than by names of individual things. We don't ordinarily think of sentences as names of a particular range of objects. So there'll be an issue about this kind of generalisation, even if we like the look of it. There'll be an issue about this kind of generalisation, which will be to do with making sense of this kind of generalisation over sentence position. But we'll try and come back to that. So suppose we have something like, we certainly have the initial platitudes in hand, we have some idea about how the platitudes work, which tends to prioritise the simple non-truth involving claim over claim involving talk about a proposition and it's having a property of truth or untruth. And perhaps we have this kind of propositional generalisation that covers all those cases, and all this seems moderately platitudinous. What more can we say about the concept or nature of truth? That's a paradigmatically philosophical project, saying more about what truth comes to. In particular, can we spell out the kind of commonality seemingly captured in the propositional generalisation in order to explain the underlying nature of that commonality, what all these cases have in common that makes them susceptible of truth? Right, the analogue of appeal in trying to account for the commonality of all pink things, the appeal there to things like spectral reflectance properties, properties of the electronic surface of objects and the like. So even if we accept the platitudes, looks like there's potentially more philosophical work to be done in explaining why those platitudes obtain. What brings all those platitudes together and explains that that one common thing we always attribute when we say of propositions that they're true. So I want to consider two attempts to say more here. They're not the only two attempts one might consider, but they're probably the two central attempts, the two that have figured most widely in philosophical reflections here. So the first one is a version of the so-called correspondence theory of truth. So the correspondence theory tries to say something more general about what pulls all these platitudinous cases together, and it tries to say something like this. The proposition that P is true, just in case the proposition that P corresponds with the fact that P. Okay, it tries to say that with respect to all of the interesting cases. So it says that what it is for a proposition to be true is for that proposition to stand in a distinctive kind of relation to something else. A fact. Which fact? Well, the relevant fact, the fact that P, where the proposition is the proposition that P. So what it is for a proposition to be true is for it to stand in this kind of marked out relationship to some other entity, fact. And one thing that drives this kind of a theory, this kind of account, is a further seeming platitude that some people want to appeal to, according to which where propositions are true, they're true because of the way the world is. Okay? Because, in other words, of the facts. Okay, so where you've got a proposition that's true, where it's true that Jeremy should resign, for example, that proposition is made true. What explains its truth is the way the world is. Okay? And another way of putting that is to say that what makes it true is the facts. And now the correspondence theory goes slightly beyond that seeming platitude that what makes things true or false is the facts by attempting to specify which amongst the facts makes the proposition true. Right? It's not just the facts in general. I can be more specific. What makes it true that Jeremy should resign is the fact that Jeremy should resign. Okay? That's a form of classical correspondence theory. So perhaps it's some kind of a platitude that where we think things are true, we think they're true because of the way the world is, rather than, for example, thinking that the world is the way it is because propositions about the world are true, right? Be a different kind of priority. But as I've said, the correspondence theory goes beyond that minimal platitude by viewing particular propositions as being true because they bear a particular sort of relation, correspondence, to particular facts. Not to the facts in general or the world in general, but to particular, so to speak, chunks of the world, individual facts that perhaps together constitute a world of facts. So that's the kind of view, correspondence theory. The view raises three obvious, very basic questions. These aren't objections, they're just questions that need to be addressed by a proponent of this style of view. There are three basic questions corresponding to three moving parts of the account. Question one, what is a proposition? Right? Your account of truth makes appeal to propositions. What are those things? Well, I think that's okay because everyone probably in this area is going to have to say something about what propositions are. We move into territory distinctive of the correspondence theory with our other questions. So the next question that arises for this view is, what is a fact? Tell us what facts are. Even if we think we have a grasp on what propositions are, we don't yet know what the other crucial plank in your account is facts. What are they? Need to tell us something about their nature before we can understand your overarching account of what truth consists in. The third question, obviously enough, is what is this relation of correspondence you claim to obtain between propositions and facts, just in case the propositions are made true by the facts? What relation is that? And correspondence here looks to be a technical term. And note, right, that you can't appeal to our understanding of truth in order to explain what this relation is if you adopt a correspondence theory of truth. You can't say, well, correspondence is just whatever relation obtains between a proposition and a fact when the proposition's true. Because, right, the puzzle was what truth comes to. If we already understood that, we'd perhaps have no need for this kind of metaphysical account. Okay, so look, one could easily spend a whole course of lectures or more talking about these theories of truth. I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to point to ways in which worries about these theories of truth lead naturally into minimalist or deflationary theories, views of truth. So I'm going to point to ways in which there are specific concerns about these sorts of views that lead in that direction, some of which arise from those questions and the need to answer them, and some of which arise from the way that these specific views we're going to consider interact with the platitudes we started with, okay? Come into kind of tension with the platitudes. So suppose I ask what I need to check in order to determine whether the proposition that David's pink is true. According to the platitude governing this case, I simply have to check whether David's pink, right? That was where we started. That's all I need to do. And that seems to be a correct and natural thing to say. Okay, if you want to find out whether it's true that David's pink, or whether the proposition that David's pink is true, see whether David's pink. By contrast, according to the correspondence theory, it's at least on its face mysterious that that can be all that I need to do to find out whether this proposition is true. According to the correspondence theory, it's natural to think that I should need instead to check whether the proposition that David's pink stands in this distinctive relationship of correspondence to the fact that David's pink. Right? Looks like I need to check all that, given this account, to find out whether the proposition is true. Because it's only if all of that obtains that the proposition is true, according to this account. So it's natural to think that the correspondence theory demands more of us than what ought to be demanded, given the platitudes. Right? Platitude, want to know whether the proposition that David's pink is true, see whether David's pink. Correspondence theory, you want to know whether the proposition that David's pink is true, see whether that proposition stands in the relation of correspondence with the fact that David's pink. Okay, so one worry is that, at least on its face, correspondence theory imposes demands on us that we don't ordinarily take ourselves to need to meet, that certainly go beyond what look to be more natural requirements imposed by the platitudes. Alternatively, suppose we think that that's overreading the commitments of the correspondence theory. Okay, so we might think that that's really unfair, or the correspondence theory can say all you need to do is see whether David's pink, because seeing that is determining whether or not the proposition stands in relation to correspondence to the facts. All that means, all that talk about relations to correspondence to the facts, all that amounts to is a kind of restatement of the initial claim that David's pink. So all you really need to check is whether David's pink. But in that case, we might reasonably think that the correspondence theory just presents an overly verbose way of stating the platitudes with which we started. In which case, we haven't really said anything substantive about truth. At best, we've added to the terminology available to philosophers to restate the obvious. So there's at least the opening of a kind of challenge to the correspondence theory here. Either explain away the appearance somehow that you're demanding too much of us in order to establish particular truths, or explain why, if you're not demanding more of us than we ordinarily think we have to do, all this talk about correspondence with the facts isn't just a kind of trivial restatement of the basic platitudes. I mean, things get a little worse for the correspondence theory here, at least construed as a non-trivial restatement, at least according to some theorists. So according to the correspondence theory, to check whether a proposition's true, I have to check the facts. Okay? Because I have to check whether the facts correspond with the proposition, right? That's part of the task. But my only access to the facts, we might reasonably think, goes via the propositions that, for example, I believe. Right? It's not like I have my beliefs about the world, but those relate me to propositions. Right? So how do I get beyond my relations to the propositions to compare the propositions I'm related to by way of belief with an independent range of entities, namely the facts? What puts me in connection with those facts? Looks like, at least on this way of thinking, I'm confined to the things I believe, and they're all propositions. Right? So what provides me with required access to the facts, so I can look at those, see whether it's a fact that David is pink, right? Find that fact, make sure it corresponds with the proposition I started with, and thus come to know that the proposition's true. If the only things I have psychological access to are propositions, the things that I think. Right, because remember, the facts on this view aren't propositions. They're distinct things that stand in a relation of correspondence to the propositions. So if all I can believe is the propositions, then I have no way of getting outside that range of propositions to check whether they correspond with the facts. So if that's right, then on this kind of view, conceived of as a substantive account of truth, we can never tell whether a proposition is true. Right? So the correspondence theory of truth leads naturally into a rather extreme form of scepticism. You can't know whether anything's true, because to know whether it's true, you have to step outside the only things you have access to, namely the propositions, and see whether they correspond with the facts. Now, this is an opening for the coherence theorist, right, the purveyor of the other main theory of truth. So the coherence theorist says, look, it surely must be possible on a reasonable account of truth to be able to tell whether or not a proposition is true. Right? Surely that's a minimal demand, right? There must at least be some things, some propositions whose truth we can establish. So truth, from that perspective, has to consist in something other than correspondence with the facts. Right? If it did consist in correspondence with the facts, we could never tell whether or not a proposition is true. Since we can tell, since it's a reasonable demand on any good account of truth that we can at least sometimes tell whether things are true, we should give up the correspondence theory of truth in favour of a view that allows us, sometimes at least, to come to know that things are true. Now, coherence theorist, right, in driving this objection to the correspondence theorist, accepts one of the premises of that objection, which is that all we have access to is propositions that we believe. So that's all that we have access to. So it's natural for them to think, insofar as they want to give an account of truth that's substantive, that the account of truth is going to involve something about the propositions and nothing else. In particular, nothing like facts that we don't have any access to. So the coherence theorist seeks to give an account of truth by appeal not to relations between propositions and these external facts, but rather relations amongst the propositions themselves. These are taken to be things that we do have access to through belief. So the coherence theorist uses relations amongst propositions and our access to the propositions we believe to drive their account, and their account, or one version of their account, is the following, the coherence account. The proposition that P is true, just in case the proposition that P coheres with other propositions that are believed. Okay? And that's supposed to be something that one can establish even while confined within the bounds of propositions. As with the correspondence theory, this question, this account raises various questions, right? Some of which are the same questions as arose for the correspondence theory. What are propositions? Okay, perhaps that's unfair, because perhaps everyone needs some kind of an answer to that question. Okay, so what exactly, question two, specific to the account, what exactly must propositions cohere with? Is it propositions believed by everyone, right? Is what it takes for my beliefs to be true that the propositions I believe cohere with all of your propositions, or Is it enough if they cohere with at least someone's propositions? Is all that matters that they cohere with my own propositions believed? Is it all of the propositions that are believed, or only some of them, most of them, or what? So in order to put flesh on the coherence theory, we need answers to these questions before we can even get as far as assessing the theory. Right? We need to know what the theory is committed to. Insofar as this question is hard to answer, for example, by mere reflection on our concept of truth, that's going to be a problem for the purveyor of this kind of account. Right? I mean, this will connect up with worries about arbitrariness. Right, suppose I said, oh yeah, my view, my coherence theory is that you have to, you believe your propositions have to cohere with 10 other propositions. That's the right view, surely. Right, isn't it obvious that 10 propositions is the right number? I think, no, that's nonsense. Okay, so we need a non-arbitrary answer to the question, to what extent propositions have to cohere with this proposition in order for it to be true. You might say, well, all of them, obviously enough, but that looks far too demanding. Right, because surely you have some false beliefs, and you might think you don't want whether your belief, this belief, is true to depend on its cohering with false beliefs, right, for example. And third, we need to know what this relation of coherence is. Is it mere consistency, or is it something more demanding? Right, you might think it's mere consistency, but you might worry that mere consistency couldn't be enough to sustain truth. So many theorists want to impose stricter conditions. They want the idea that where you have a coherent set of propositions, some amongst those propositions explain why some of the other propositions should be believed. Something stronger than mere coherence, mere consistency. Okay, so again, something to be said here, and it can't be purely arbitrary, right? It has to have some basis in our thinking about truth. So a concern, I mean, there are all kinds of concerns one might have about coherence theory, for example, about the possibility of coherent fairy tales. This is a very old worry about the coherence theory. You might think you can spin a story that's internally perfectly coherent by any standard, certainly by standards of consistency. And you might think that couldn't be enough for that fairy story to turn out to be true. Right? One response will be to try and impose tougher conditions on coherence, but it's not clear that that will do the job. So, different concern, more connected with the worries we're pressing here, concerns the fit between the coherence theory and, again, the platitudes, which we started. So it looks like on this view, to figure out whether the proposition that David's pink's true, one needs to do something other than simply figuring out whether David's pink. One needs to figure out whether the proposition that he's pink adheres with some or all of the other things one believes. Okay. I think that's a big, big task. I need to sit down and carefully reflect on relations between this proposition that David's pink and lots of the other things that you believe, just in order to tell whether this one's true. So these questions and concerns that I've suggested arise for those two traditional theories of truth shouldn't be thought at all to be decisive, right? There's tons of stuff that the proponent of those kinds of theories will try and say in response. Okay, I wouldn't take anything I've said here really to amount to more than a suggested concern one might have or a question. Right, nothing I've said is a decisive objection. However, the persistence of debate between the defenders of these two sorts of theory, together with the various unclarities in their foundations, right? What are facts? What's correspondence? What's coherence? Have motivated a different kind of response. So the issue here, right, in part is kind of a reflection on the history of the subject. I mean, what we just saw was start with the correspondence theory, which seems kind of natural, seems to fit with some aspects of the platitudes. try and spin out such an account, but ultimately it gets into trouble. It's at least got problems. They may not be decisive problems, but they're problems. In light of those problems, one flips over into a different kind of view that seeks to avoid those problems, the coherence theory. That then faces problems of its own, including this kind of coherent fairy tale problem. One response to the coherent fairy tale problem would be to flip back and say, oh yeah, what goes wrong with a coherent fairy tale is precisely that it fails to correspond with the facts. Okay? So you flip back to the correspondence theory. And that's that's just a description of the history of the subject, right? That's just how this bit of philosophy goes. It's how lots of bits of philosophy go. And one reaction is just to keep digging, right? Keep going at these issues harder and harder. But a different kind of response is to worry that all of these issues and all of this flip-flopping between different positions was driven by a kind of false start, by a kind of assumption driving the projects, the ongoing projects that we've seen lead into difficulties, where the assumption is something like the assumption that there's anything substantive and general to be said about the nature of truth. What's gone wrong isn't specific problems in those accounts, it's rather a problem generated by the assumption that there's anything of this kind to be said by philosophers, anything deep and general to be said about truth. Okay, so different kind of approach motivated at that point tries to shed that assumption that there's anything very useful to be said at that general level. So the platitudes we started with and some others appear to be plausible and to be very widely accepted. That's what makes them into platitudes. When we attempt to go beyond the platitudes to provide a kind of general account, deep-seeming questions arise about facts, correspondence, coherence, and so forth, and it's proved very difficult to answer those questions in a satisfying way, certainly in a way that carries widespread conviction, convinces more than the purveyor of that particular theory. Moreover, the answers to those questions have appeared to be in at least some tension with the platitudes with which we started. There haven't been ways of articulating, developing and defending those platitudes. Rather, they've delivered theories that are at least in some seeming tension with those platitudes. And as I've mentioned, there's been a history of dispute amongst defenders of various substantive accounts of truth, with little sign that anything close to consensus is emerging. And that might be a sign that this is just very hard, but it might be a sign that some false assumption was made early on and has driven us into the arms of flip-flopping between unsatisfying accounts. And these facts about the traditional debate have led, as I said, to a very different approach to our question about truth. And this would be some form of deflationary or minimalist theory about truth. Deflationary or minimalist because it tries to avoid saying more or much more than is ensconced in the platitudes with which we started. Okay, but I'm going to say more about that range of approaches next time. Thank you.